The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Morris Williams, and I am a member of the Free Library of Philadelphia's Foundation Board of Directors. And it's my privilege tonight to welcome you to the Free Library, and also in this modern day and age, to ask you to turn off your cell phones and to remind you that no flash photography, please. This is an exciting time at the library. In addition to having outstanding winners of Nobel Prizes with us, I'm just thrilled to report that all 54 branches of the Free Library of Philadelphia are open 6 days a week. And so I want to say thank you to all of you who have been so vigorous in your support of the library, and I want to say thank you to all the members of City Council and the mayor for their renewed and increased support of the library, and we look forward to increased resources coming for the library because of its importance as both a resource, as an opportunity for people of all ages to learn and to gain pleasure and enjoyment, and also to help to bridge the digital divide that still exists in our society. There is, in addition to the list of upcoming author events, there's one that you should add that is part of a new series that the library is sponsoring. On April the 19th, there will be a panel discussion around the subject of gambling. And, of course, that is something that is quite important in terms of what's taking place in Philadelphia and the state of Pennsylvania. And it's part of the role that the library plays in terms of bringing people who can examine issues. And it will be an important conversation. And I will just alert you to the fact that in the fall, there will be a conversation around the subject of violence. Of course, tonight we have Dr. Martia Sen, who is just back from India, and so brings a wide perspective. His book, Identity and Violence, I think is a book that all of you want to buy, both and most importantly because of the content of the ideas that he brings, but also because of the fact that you can get it signed upstairs after the lecture by our wonderful author. There's an excellent description of his biography in your program, and I won't repeat that. But I think the thing that impresses me most about Dr. Sen is the range of ideas that he explores and has explored over the course of his career. Of course, he's most known because he won the Nobel Prize in Economics. But in 1970, he wrote a book about collective choice and social welfare, highlighting a conversation that is ongoing and extremely timely today about global welfare. And I think that his work in ethics, in the intersection of ethics and the business community and the life of individuals and the life of community, is extremely important. And, of course, his global perspective, native of India, having taught in Europe as well as now teaching at Harvard, where he is the Lamont University professor, a post, quote, reserved for individuals of distinction working on the frontiers of knowledge and in such a way as to cross the conventional boundaries of the specialties. And so I think in both his comments and in the Q&A, we will be able to plumb some of those wide range of interests that have led to his writing over 25 books that have been translated into over 30 languages and have helped to bring enlightenment throughout the world. And so please join me in welcoming Dr. Sen to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Well, I'm really delighted to be here and like to thank the library for this very kind invitation, and Mr. Williams for very kind words. I only disagreed with him at one point, that while I hope you will read the book, it's much more cost-effective to borrow it from a library. And the free library, of course, would be a particularly good place to borrow it from. But I'm really very happy, and thank you all for coming. I'll try to say something about the book, though it's a bit difficult to describe one's own book because one is too contaminated with it. But I'll try, and so I've chosen some bits of it to indicate what the book is about, really. The violent events and atrocities of the last few years, from what happened on September 11, 2001 in New York, to less gigantic but similarly bloody events across the world, have ushered in a period of terrible confusions, as well as dreadful conflicts. The politics of global confrontation is frequently seen as a corollary of religious or cultural divisions in the world. Indeed, the world is increasingly understood, if only implicitly, as a collectivity of religions or of civilizations, thereby ignoring all the other ways in which people see themselves. Underlying this line of thinking is the odd presumption that the people of the world can be uniquely categorized according to some singular and overarching system of partitioning. Civilizational or religious partitioning of the world population yields a solitarist approach to human identity, which sees human beings as members of exactly one group, in this case defined by civilization or religion. A solitarist approach can be an excellent way of misunderstanding nearly everyone in the world. In our normal lives, we see ourselves as members of a variety of groups. We belong to all of them. The same person can be, without any contradiction, a British citizen of Malaysian origin, with Chinese ancestry, a Christian, a liberal, a woman, a vegetarian, a long-distance runner, a historian, a school teacher, a novelist, a feminist, a heterosexual, a believer in gay and lesbian rights, a theater lover, an environmental activist, a tennis fan, a jazz musician, and someone who is deeply committed to the view that there are intelligent beings in outer space who should be given with whom it's extremely urgent to talk, preferably in English, and who should be given the opportunity to read Shakespeare without further delay. Each of these collectivities, to all of which this one person simultaneously belongs, gives her a particular identity, and depending on the context, could be a very important identity. None of them can be taken to be the person's only identity or singular membership category. Given our inescapably plural identities, we have to decide on the relative importance of our different associations and affiliations in any particular context. Tensions involved in the disparate demands and contrary loyalties have, of course, been much discussed in literature. For example, in his poem, indeed a wonderful poem, A Far Cry from Africa, Derek Walcott beautifully articulates the conflicting pulls in his Caribbean setting between his historical African roots and the demands of his acquired loves and commitments, including that to the English language, the language of the empire. I read a little from the poem. Where shall I turn, divided to the vein? I who have cursed the drunken officer of the British rule, how choose between this Africa and the English tongue I love? Betray them both, or give back what they give? How can I face such slaughter and be cool? How can I turn from Africa and live? The need to reflect and to decide on the choice of priorities over competing identities is part of leading a life, no matter how hard the choice is sometimes. The cultivation of a singular identity to the exclusion of all other manifold associations not only draws on an impoverished view of identity, it can also generate some terrible consequences. Indeed, it can kill, and kill with abandon. A strong and exclusive sense of belonging to one group can go with the perception of distance and divergence from other groups. Within group solidarity can help to feed between group discord. That's one of the problems with those things which we admire a lot with good reason, like a sense of community, like what is called social capital, doing things for each other within the community. It's the tension which I'm looking at. We may be suddenly informed that we are not just Rwandans, but specifically Hutus. We hate Tutsis. Or that we are not really mere Yugoslavs, but actually Serbs. We absolutely don't like Muslims. From my own childhood memory of Hindu-Muslim riots in the 1940s, linked with the politics of partition, I recollect the speed with which the broad human beings of January were suddenly transformed into ruthless Hindus and fierce Muslims of July. Hundreds of thousands perished at the hands of people who, led by the commanders of carnage, killed others on behalf of their, quote-unquote, own people. Central to leading a human life are the responsibilities of choice and reasoning. In contrast, violence is promoted by the cultivation of a sense of inevitability about some allegedly unique and often belligerent identity that we are supposed to have, and which apparently makes extensive demands on us, sometimes of a most disagreeable kind. The imposition of an allegedly unique identity is often a crucial component of the martial art of fomenting sectarian confrontation. Unfortunately, not only the fierce and the crass thesis of the clash of civilizations, which draws on a very foggy perception and reading of history, but also many well-intended attempts to stop interreligious violence are based on the presumption of a singular identity of each person, one identity per person, related to the so-called civilization to which the person belongs, allegedly, uniquely. The perceived absence of choice about our identities implicit in such a reading can seriously damage our ability to defeat violence. When the prospects of good relations among different human beings are seen, as they increasingly are, primarily in terms of, and this is the good side, that is, not the clash side, but the friendship side, in terms of amity among civilizations, or dialogue between religious groups, or friendly relations between different communities. At the moment, there is a United Nations committee working on dialogue between civilizations. Ignoring the great many different ways in which different persons, different individuals relate to each other, a serious miniaturization of human beings precedes the devised programs for peace. Our shared humanity gets savagely challenged when the manifold divisions in the world are unified into one allegedly dominant system of classification in terms of religion or community or culture or nation or civilization, treating each to be uniquely powerful in the context of that particular approach to war and peace. One of the main theses of the book is that the illusion of a uniquely partitioned world is much more divisive than the universe of plural and diverse categories that characterize the actual world in which we live. It goes not only against the old-fashioned belief that we human beings are all much the same, a view that tends to be ridiculed these days, sensibly enough, as much too soft-headed, but also against the less discussed, but much more plausible understanding that we are diversely different. The hope of harmony in the contemporary world lies to a great extent in a clearer understanding of the pluralities of human identity and in the appreciation that they cut across each other and work against a sharp separation along one single hardened line of impenetrable division. A centrally important issue is the critical role of choice in the understanding and use of our identities, in the determination of significant identities as well as their relative importance vis-à-vis each other. Since we do belong to a great many different groups related to nationality, location, class, occupation, language, literature, politics, convictions, taste, and many others, the importance that we attach respectively to each of these memberships must at least partly be a matter of choice. Another central thesis of the book is the importance of recognizing the inescapable role of decision in the way we see ourselves. It's not a natural phenomenon. The neglect of the plurality of our affiliations and of the need for choice and reasoning obscures the world in which we live. It pushes us in the direction of the terrifying prospects portrayed by that great poem of Matthew Arnold, with which I'm sure most of you are familiar, called Dover Beach. I quote a few lines from it. And we are here on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night. I think it's a marvelous description of some of the things happening tonight. Conceptual disarray, ignorant armies clashing by night, and not just nasty intentions, significantly contribute to the turmoil and barbarity that we see around us. The illusion of destiny, particularly about some singular identity or other, and their alleged implications, nurtures violence in the world through omissions as well as commissions. We have to see clearly that we have many distinct affiliations and can interact with each other as individuals in a great many different ways, no matter what the instigators and their flustered opponents tell us, and that we ourselves have to make centrally important decisions about our own lives rather than being swept away by community-based choicelessness. The book is concerned with the intellectual roots of global violence and the confrontation that conceptual clarity can make to defeating violence around the world. It takes on a number of different but interrelated issues. From the corruption of the demands of multiculturalism as a political idea to the undermining of the prospects of global democracy in the contemporary world. To begin with multiculturalism, we could ask, is multiculturalism, what is it? Is it nothing other than the tolerance of diversity of cultures, the way it is normally interpreted? But does it make a difference? Who chooses the cultural practices? Whether they're imposed on young children in the name of quote-unquote the culture of the community, or whether they are freely chosen by persons with adequate opportunity to learn and reason about alternatives. Being born in a particular community is not an act of choice nor an exercise of freedom. What facilitates What facilities do members of different communities have, in schools as well as in the society at large, to learn about the faiths and non-faiths of different people in the world, and to understand how to reason about choices that human beings must, if only implicitly, make? A crucially important issue concerns the distinction between multiculturalism and what I call plural monoculturalism. Plural monoculturalism. Thus, the existence of a diversity of cultures which might pass each other like ships at night counter the successful case of multiculturalism. That distinction is, I think, critically important for Europe and America today. For example, the recent British attempt to expand the coverage of state-financed faith schools to have Muslim schools, Hindu schools, Sikh schools, in addition to old Christian ones, not only reflect a confused interpretation of the demands of multiculturalism, seen essentially as plural monoculturalism, but it also helps to generate the divisive society that British policy in other spheres is very much aimed at countering. Indeed, the encouragement and support given in Britain to new free faith schools reflects simultaneously the hallowing of inherited tradition over trying to educate children to make reasoned choices, and giving automatic priority to religion over politics, civil society, language, or literature, despite the token mixture of student population planned for the faith schools. Prime Minister Blair was certainly right to note, while defending the policy of state-supported faith schools, that, I quote from Blair, there is a very strong sense of ethos and values in those schools, which he gives as a reason for having these schools paid for by the state. But education is not just about getting children immersed in inherited ethos. It's also about developing the ability to reason about choices that a person would have to make, and the cultivation of the skill and the ability of comparing, scrutinizing, assessing alternative beliefs and non-beliefs that exist in the world. A central issue to be faced today is the content of education. Education for all, not just for immigrants and minorities. Much will depend on how the non-immigrant communities, the old Brits, the old French, the established Americans, and so on, should see the demands of multicultural education and intellectual awareness. Should it take the form of leaving each community to do their own special historical celebrations, combined at best with respectful noises to other religious communities, without responding to the need for all to be more fully aware of the global interrelations in the origins and development of world civilization? I discuss these global roots extensively in the book. Just to give an example of it, when a mathematician at Penn sits down in the context of a computational exercise to do an algorithm, he or she implicitly invokes the name and the work of a 9th century Arab Muslim mathematician called Al-Khwarizmi, from whose name, Al-Khwarizmi, the term algorithm is derived, and from his book, from whose book, Al-Jabr Muqabila, the term algebra is derived. But you would find very little interest in that in the context of Britain, which I'm discussing, but would apply also often to America, in the standard British schools or Christian schools, but very little of that in Muslim school either, because they're not concerned with the history of Muslim people, broadly conceived, but Islamic history in particular, an algorithm doesn't fall into it. So it actually doesn't figure anywhere at all. If the roots of so-called Western science or culture draw inter alia on Chinese innovations, Indian and Arabic mathematics, or West Asian preservation of Greco-Roman heritage, which, with, for example, Arabic translations of forgotten Greek classics being retranslated into Latin many centuries later, should there not be much more reflection of that robust interactive past than can be found at this time in the curriculum of European and American schools? If one issue concerning faith schools involved the problematic nature of giving priority to unreasoned faith over reasoning, there's another momentous issue here, which concerns the role of religion in categorizing people. Rather than using other bases of classification, people's priorities and actions are influenced by all their affiliations and associations, not merely by religion. For example, the separation of Bangladesh from Pakistan was based on reasons of language and literature, along with political priorities, including secular priorities, not on religion, which both wings of undivided Pakistan shared. Even within Pakistan today, because of the gradual emergence of a courageous media willing to take many risks, and many of the leading journalists have in fact been in prison, there's quite a feast of perspective in the recently developed vigorous Pakistani press. And yet the world leaders of the so-called war on terror tend to keep their dialogue in Pakistan confined entirely to the military and to the official government leaders, as if the civil society is of no importance at all. There's an uncanny similarity between the problem that Britain faces today and those that British India faced, and which Mahatma Gandhi thought were getting direct encouragement from the Raj. Gandhi was critical, in particular, of the official view, British view, that India was a collection of religious communities. When Gandhi came to London for the Indian Roundtable Conference called by the British government in 1931, as a gesture of trying to cool sentiments in India, this is very soon after the Amritsar massacre, Gandhi found that he was assigned to a specific sectarian corner in the revealingly named Federal Structure Committee. That's how the future of India is to be thought of, as a federal structure. The idea of partition, in fact, was first proposed by the British. Gandhi resented the fact that he was being depicted by the British rulers at that meeting primarily as a spokesman of Hindus, in particular upper caste Hindus, with the remaining population being quote-unquote represented by chosen delegates, chosen by the British Prime Minister, of each of the quote-unquote other communities. Gandhi insisted that while he himself was a Hindu, the political movement that he led was not a community-based movement. It had supporters from all the different religious groups in India. While he saw that a distinction can be made on religious lines, he pointed to the fact that other ways of dividing the population of India were no less relevant. Gandhi made a powerful plea for the British rulers to see the plurality of the diverse identities of Indians. In fact, he said he wanted to speak not for Hindus in the religious classification in particular, but for, in a different classification, I quote from Gandhi, the dumb, toiling, semi-starved millions who constitute over 85% of the population of India, unquote. Gender was another basis for an important distinction which Gandhi pointed out the British categories completely ignored, thereby giving no special place to considering the problems of Indian women. He told the British Prime Minister, I quote from Gandhi, "You have had on behalf of the women a complete repudiation of special representation, which you apply to religion," and pointed to the fact that, I quote again, "they happen to be, that is, women happen to be one half of the population of India." Sarojini Naidu, who came with Gandhi to the Round Table Conference, was the only woman delegate to the conference. Gandhi pointed to the fact that Sarojini Naidu was elected as the president of the Congress Party, by a long margin the largest party and Gandhi's own party. Sarojini Naidu, in fact, was elected to the office of heading the leading party of India in 1925, which entirely, by the way, I point out, is 50 years before any woman was elected to preside over any major British political party. That happened in 1975 when Margaret Thatcher was elected the leader of Conservative Party. I might add that politeness prevents me from discussing when that happened in America. Gandhi pointed out that Sarojini Naidu, quote, on the British Raj's representational, quote-unquote, line of reasoning, speak for half the Indian people, namely Indian women, if we divided the Indian population differently from the way the Raj was doing. Abdul Qayyum, another delegate from the Northwest Frontier Province, a Muslim delegate, as the name would indicate to you, of what is now Pakistan, pointed out also to the fact that Sarojini Naidu, whom he called the Nightingale of India, was the only distinguished poet, indeed the one distinguished poet, in the assembled gathering, a very different kind of identity to which Qayyum pointed from being seen as a Hindu politician. Gandhi's complete refusal to accept and cultivate a singular categorization of the people in terms of religions and communities remains widely relevant today. If the implicit acceptance of the extraordinary view that Britain is, quote-unquote, a federation of distinct communities and ethnicities, that phrase first figured in the powerful, important document in Britain called The Future of Multi-Ethnic Britain, but been widely quoted again, if that view has gained ground in the post-imperial Britain and is beginning to make its contribution not only to homegrown disaffection, but also to homegrown terrorism, including Al-Qaeda recruitment among British-born and domestically reared Muslims, the roots of that violence lie at least as much in conceptual confusion and disorientation as in any inherent propensity towards the violence of potential recruits. I might mention that as an Indian, as a small child, then it did appear to us that the British were planting this idea of community-based identity as a divide and rule. But now that the British are doing it to themselves, I think we attribute it to perfidy, what could be attributed more easily to confounding and confusion. That, by the way, is a generous statement. If there is something of importance in Gandhi's warning about singular classifications for the British policymakers, in his case in India, but I'm trying to make it in Britain today, there is also something relevant here, I add, for American makers of policy, not just in this country, but also in occupied Iraq. The need for public interaction and the operation of civil society across the narrow barriers of religious communities would be very hard to overemphasize. It's central to the operation of a functioning democracy too. I've tried to discuss fairly extensively in the book why democracy cannot be seen as a purely Western cultural condition, or even as a purely Western product of history. Democracy is political decision-making through participatory public reasoning, of which voting is a part, but only one part. And there's a widespread history in the world of putative cultivation of that value of participatory public reasoning. I give lots of examples of that from Japan to Africa, but a lot of that in India, particularly in the Buddhist period, of that going back to certainly 3rd century, well, actually 6th century BC, when the first council was held for settling disputes through discussion, the first of the Buddhist council there were. That was 6th century BC, shortly after Buddha's death. The next one was 5th century. The biggest one done by Ashoka was the 3rd century, who also tried to write up rules for public discussion. I think a kind of early Robert's Rule of Order, I think probably the earliest 3rd century BC, is pretty early for that. Now, this attempt at participatory public discussion has, of course, had its ups and downs everywhere, certainly often utterly suppressed for long stretches in any country in the world, including in the West. And the fact that the West has been able to make excellent use of that mode of decision-making over the last 2 centuries or so is a matter of global celebration, rather than being made into a parochial theory of purely Western democracy, ignoring the global past. It's particularly important to see that democracy does demand not just voting, but also a civil society that is not fragmented into little boxes of community in a hardened way. While it's easy enough to understand the widespread and increasing doubts about armed counterproductive intervention in Iraq, allegedly aimed at jump-starting democracy there through largely foreign and military planning, along with the pursuit of other not typically loftier motivations that guided the U.S.-led invasion, it would be quite a leap from there to become skeptical of the general possibility of the emergence of democracy in any country that is currently non-democratic. If it was natural for Gandhi to recollect the long history of public reasoning in India, despite many adversities, it was equally natural for Nelson Mandela to discuss in his autobiography, The Long Walk to Freedom, how he learned about democracy, how he learned what democracy was as a child by watching the open discussion that took place in the Regent's House in his local tribal community. What is needed in the Middle East today is not only the cultivation of a civil society that is not splintered as severely as it is now by religious divisiveness, but also a recollection of a past in which tolerance and dialogue did, contrary to what is generally acknowledged, receive great respect. Just to give a couple of examples of that, and there are many others I discuss in the book. In the 12th century, Maimonides could find a secure base for his work and arguments in the court of Emperor Saladin, when that distinguished, outstanding Jewish philosopher found Europe intolerable and had to leave it. First went to Morocco and then to Egypt. To give another example, in the 15th century, Emperor Akbar was completing his codification of the rights of all, including of religious groups not linked with the imperial power, and arranging dialogues between Hindus, Muslims, Christians, Jews, Parsis, Jains, and others, by the way, including atheists. This was just when the heretic Giordano Bruno was burnt at the stake in Campo dei Fiori in Rome because of apostasy. These too are parts of the history of Muslim people, not just Islamic extremism, and something which the people who confuse Muslim history with Islamic history overlook. And that history in the hands of a local Mandela, not, I fear, some American or British general, that could provide insights using the interactive past to reinterpret it in the light of living reality today, in the way Europe did also at an earlier period. The use of public reasoning across the narrow barriers of religious communities is precisely what is lacking in the allegedly democratic Iraq today. Given the nature of military operations in general, of which the Iraq intervention is a particularly gross example, it would have been difficult to expect the emergence of an interactive civil society in occupied Iraq. Indeed, the fostering of democracy in the Middle East requires a different approach altogether. But following the ill-planned intervention, problems have been compounded further by acting on the presumption that balloting is all that is needed for a democracy rather than the growth of a civil society and a healthy and functioning media. And this has further compounded Iraq's problems in having a democracy. The solitary focus on religious categorization has implications also for the way global identities, I'm now moving to a different issue, and the last one I want to discuss in the time allotted to me, that solitary focus, it has implications also for the way global identities are seen and invoked today, and how it's been diminished. If a person can have only one identity at most, then the choice between the national and the global becomes an all-or-nothing contest. And so does the conflict between any global sense of belonging we may have and the local loyalties that may also move us. But to see the problem in these stark and exclusive terms reflects a profound misunderstanding of the nature of human identity, in particular, its inescapable plurality. Recognizing the need to consider the claims of a global identity does not eliminate the possibility of paying attention also to local and national problems. The role of reasoning and choice in the determination of priorities need not take the either-or form. A number of economic and social and political problems have global dimensions, which have to be urgently addressed. And I've tried to discuss them in some detail, I fear, in the book. There is in particular a strong case for institutional reform that would facilitate the kind of change that would be needed to make globalization a fairer arrangement. I'm very pro-globalization. It's also very clear that the benefits of globalization are equitably shared. The adversities faced by the vulnerable and insecure have to be addressed on different fronts. The range of necessary actions vary from national policies, which we mustn't forget in the world of globalism. For example, the urgency of expanding through national state policy the reach of education and public health care within the nation, to international initiatives and institutional reforms, related, for example, to the global arrangements for curbing arms trade. It's worth recollecting in this context that more than 85% of the armament in the world are exported by the G8 countries themselves, and more than 80% are exported by the 5 permanent members of the Security Council. There hasn't been much censorious debate in the Security Council on this subject. There are other examples involving expanding the access of poorer countries to the markets of the richer economies, and vice versa, making patent laws more friendly to the development and usability of medicine needed by the poor of the world, and so on. These changes would be of importance of their own, but they can also contribute to greater human security and to a fuller recognition of our global identities, which can also help to reduce the scope for easy recruitment for terrorism and training of disaffected young men and women, actually, also. They can contribute, furthermore, to changing the climate of tolerance of violence, which is itself a very large factor in allowing terrorism to be nurtured in societies with deep grievances, often relating to the imperial past. The book rambles on, but I must not do that right now. And so I stop at pointing to some problem that I've tried to discuss in the book and which I've just mentioned. Cassius stole Brutus. The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves, that we are underlings. Something similar can be said about the abuse of the ideas of identity and culture in the contemporary world. The diversity of the human past and the freedoms of the contemporary world give us much more decisional power, if we are ready to seize it, than social and cultural determinists acknowledge. This is particularly important to emphasize today, since the illusion of destiny, which, by the way, is the subtitle of the book, since the illusion of destiny can extract a very heavy price in the continued impoverishment of human lives and liberties. Thank you.
Go for about 20 minutes or so.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Sen is willing to answer questions. I'm Elliot Shellcrott, the president of the library, and I'm delighted to be able to help in this process. We have volunteers, one on each side with microphones, and we want to be sure that you everybody can hear, and we'd like you to raise your hand, and we'll get one of our volunteers to you ASAP. There's a hand, actually two right here. Why don't we take you, sir, and then the gentleman next to you.
Dr. Sen, you mentioned that you're pro-globalization and that you're keen that the benefits be equitably distributed. We have a fairly large contingent of business school students here, and I would like to hear your views on how that can be achieved. And my concern is that that might lead to a very high social deadweight loss, which is distributed among nations and also carry a spillover to developing economies. So your views on that?
Yeah, I better get back to the microphone. It's a good, very good question. What you're pointing to is, I think, a very... What I believe, I don't mean to be criticizing you, but I think it's a common confusion to think that equity requires primarily redistribution. I think that it may also require. I'm a great believer in national health service and proper social security for all. But those are rather special cases, special domains like healthcare, basic education. That tends to happen in most countries, and so on. But what I discuss in the book is that the primary way of doing it is generating the opportunity of being able to earn an income. And that would apply to people who can. Of course, if you can't for some reason because you're too old or too disabled by illness or deformity. Obviously, I'm not talking about that. But for the bulk of the people, really people's ability to have a decent income turns on primarily the one resource they have, which is labor, with the different levels of skill. So I think it concentrates national policy-wise, as I mentioned, education, basic healthcare also, if you're constantly ill, not easy to earn an income or keep a job. And also depends on how you're able to produce commodities which can be sold in the world, and therefore access to the world market is very important, extraordinarily important thing. When I was, we were talking over dinner that when I was in my 3 years as president of Oxfam, I've had a very minimal role as just an honorary president, but one of my roles was to write forwards to various publications of Oxfam. And it was interesting that Oxfam, which began at the Oxford Committee for Famine and Relief in 1942, got much more into these issues about access to markets, particularly in the world, fair trade, also the opportunities of using patent laws in a sensible way. And I think, I can't tell you how tragic I think it is that the patent laws are as silly as they are. That is not to say that I take the view that patents should be abolished and everyone should be able to buy it, and any company which imitates the dog, which can be done very cheaply often, could sell it at that. In some cases, that is justified. Indeed, among the supporters of it is William Clinton. And in the context of distributing drugs, a great supporter of organizations like Cipla, for example, in India, to make cheap drugs to use in the world. And he gives very good argument for that, too. But there is also the question, which as an economist one must recognize, of the incentive to produce the innovation that's needed. But the question is whether that innovation incentives are properly organized. You see, I think one of the peculiar things that happens is that incentives are often seen as quote-unquote a right-wing phenomenon, overlooking the fact that incentives are extremely important for more equity, and efficiency is extremely important for equity. So the deadweight loss to which you refer, and you're quite right to worry about, is something to be avoided. But what do we have now? There are very little incentive to produce drugs for those illnesses which are primarily African illnesses or Asian illnesses, Latin American, but not standardly in Europe or America. And even when some drug is developed, if you're going to charge a price which is in some sense uniform, it cuts out a lot of people. But you know, even on capitalist logic, a drug not sold cannot bring much profit. So you have to find some method of being more innovative about a pricing system. And economists have spent, maybe by the time you were doing economics, we didn't do that much. You probably didn't. But in our days, when I was young, very much the question of the multiple pricing and how you can deal with a market responding to the fact that in some places the demand could be very high and inelastic, in other cases quite low and very, very elastic. So all these could be taken into account. Roughly, we don't have a system that is fair in this respect, nor is it efficient. And I don't see them as being contrary forces in this context. We're trying to work on that next week, actually. We have a meeting in Harvard dealing with this problem, among others, and we hold it regularly. When I was Master of Trinity, we arranged one in Trinity, and it was published in Lancet, called the Trinity Papers. We dealt with some of these issues, and the editor of Lancet, Richard Horton, and Sir Michael Marmot and others, rather large figures in the English medical scene, are coming up to Harvard on our meeting. And we'll spend some time discussing all those. So we're trying to get on these things. So I think what I take from your question is the concern that you have, which is exactly right. But I think the pessimism you have is really too orthodox. So what I have to say is don't trust whatever your teachers are saying necessarily as right.
Okay, gentleman right next to you, and could you try to ask a question with a shorter answer?
Yes, okay, I'm sorry.
No, I'm just teasing.
That was a provocative question.
That's okay.
Yeah.
You talked about this forgotten tradition of tolerance and dialogue that once flourished in the Muslim world.
You have to speak more loudly.
In any
case, I'm getting, I think, with age, hard of hearing, and then after a journey from Calcutta for 24 hours or so, I'm not hearing anything at all.
I'm sorry.
I have to shout.
Okay. You talked about this forgotten tradition of tolerance and dialogue that once flourished in the Muslim world, and I understand the urgency for renewing the tradition today. My question is, whose responsibility do you see that to be, and do you think moderate Muslims are doing enough to remind more fundamentalist elements of that tradition?
I'm going to get a foul of the instruction, because that's again a very
good
question.
Worry,
yeah. 2 points there. Begin with a very minor observation, which is not central to your question, but to which I will come. The term moderate Muslim, it actually reflects just the confusion that I'm referring to, trying to capture a human being in terms of one identity. Now, what does a moderate Muslim mean? Moderation, moderateness in religion, or moderateness in politics? It's not at all clear to me why somebody could not be deeply religious and very moderate in politics. At the time of when I was talking about the 1930s, when Gandhiji, Mahatma Gandhi was involved in the politics, he was extremely religious, but very non-sectarian and very moderate indeed. Whereas Muhammad Ali Jinnah, also a great politician, who was arguing for the partition of India, was very keen on religion-based politics, not at all secular. And he was, however, he drank whiskey, ate pork, wasn't particularly religious. Now, who was the moderate religious person in that? Now, I would say that the moderate Muslims reflect exactly the confusion of trying to reduce human beings into one identity, then having only one concept left, the moderate has to capture something different from the subject matter, namely Muslim. So you end up having this completely confounding things. I mean, you're using the language, so my battle is not with you. But it's such a common language and reflects the confusion about which I'm talking. But whose responsibility? Everyone's responsibility to do that. I think it's my responsibility, if I study it, to write about it. You see, neither of these books were going to come out at this time in my case, I have to say. I was doing a book on theory of justice, which I'm sad to say Harvard is going to come out as a Belknap Press book. Harvard has announced repeatedly, Harvard University Press, since the middle 90s, as about to come out. And I was going to finish it when I had way down the list a book on India, which came out last year, The Argumentative Indian, about the tradition of argument in India and the disagreement, not trying to say which is India, but to say it's argument between them is what we are looking for in characterizing India. And the other was this. But then happened the barbarities of the Hindutva politics, including the massacre in Gujarat occurred. And I felt that even though the argumentative Indian could wait for as an intellectual project later, I felt that I had to do it straight away, so I dropped the theory of justice, went there. And as not only the terrorism, but also what seemed to me to be the crudity of the anti-terrorism things, the flustered opponents, as I described them, came through, that it seemed to me that I ought to pull forward this book also. So instead of coming out much later, I think I would have been talking about a book on theory of justice if I had my way. So I think it's my responsibility, though I was not born in a Muslim family and don't have any religious belief of that kind or any other. But that made me somehow feel that it was my responsibility. So I think we have to see these as responsibilities. If you can make a difference, there's a marvelous passage in Adam Smith saying, if you can make a difference to a situation, then you have to ask, should you not do it? Now, you may end up by saying, well, I can't do all those things. That's intelligent enough. But you can't say, none of my business. If you can make a difference, then it is your business to consider that. So I would say absolutely everyone. But I think what is to avoid is particularly the way that issue is made harder to deal with by counterproductive moves like faith schools. July 7, 2005, I was in London on that day. I actually had gone down the route of the Piccadilly line not long before that, of the bombing. But the thing to hear was that the British government, including the Prime Minister himself, whom I greatly admire, I mean, he's a terrific human being, full of generosity and humanity, but I think confused in this respect, making appeal to the Muslim community to get its act together. It's an invitation to the British Muslims not to act in the civil society with other members of the British nationality, sharing a nationality or a location or a political party, but as a member of the Muslim community. I think that's a completely, profoundly wrong move. So it's that. So it's a combination of not making the wrong move and taking an interest, actually both an epistemic interest in world history and also the recognizing the relevance of it in understanding the contemporary world. But I must stop there, otherwise I'd really had difficulty.
Okay, please raise your hand and we'll have the microphone brought to you. There's a woman right here, and then we'll go to the gentleman over on the left here.
I hope I can articulate this. I'm sure it's not my own personal belief only, but I would like to know your opinion as an economist regarding what I feel to be a rather lame direction that we are taking globally, where as a community, a world community, if we do not consume, we are to be doomed. And I just wondered if what you feel about that.
I think it's a very good question, but it's a very complex one. I have to first of all put my cards on the table. I mean, intrinsically, temperamentally, I'm not an anti-consumption person. I think, it's nice to have various things. Good food, good wine, good books, along with good conversation and other things. On the other hand, one becomes worried about the level of consumption, especially when consumption generates these other effects in terms of pollution, exhaustion of depletable resources and so on. So for me, it's not an inherently negative thing we are looking at. A lot of people, some of my friends take the view that it's basically wrong. And some of the religious taken that view. In India, for example, Jainism has tended to take that view. Alexander, by the way, when he spent a whole year in India running around, he had little skirmishes. He didn't have any major victory. He didn't take on the big Indian empire that was based on the capital in Patna. He just spent his time in Punjab finding little wars. But he had long conversations that he had already shown the inclination in chatting with Diogenes on the way. But he had long conversation, I think one or two of which I quote here, about with Jain philosophers. And among them were the anti-consumptionists already. But there was also other. There were Democrats too who told Alexander that he shouldn't think that he can rule other people's lives and so on. So all these are wonderful conversations. But I think the instinctiveness is something which makes some people often see it in a more divisive way, because we could all agree that in terms of the waste generated by consumption and the way it clogs up the world in which we live with all its consequences, we have to be very careful. And then we have to be specific. We're particularly concerned with those things which pollute. Oil, for example, would be a high thing. And, as every time I come into this country, I'm still struck by the fact, even though people complain about petrol being high priced, coming from Europe or coming from India, it's amazing how cheap it is. So I think one has to think about these things in a kind of detailed way. And I think economists, if I may rise to the defense of the profession, are actually quite aware of it. There's a lot of work going on precisely on that, how to deal with it, whether a carbon tax might do that or whether some other way of doing it. Also social initiative, and also to what extent education. I was talking about harmony in the world in the context of education, but it can also have a major environmental effect. I think the environmental education that people get in school is almost non-existent still. very tiny and very token when it exists. So I think if you press on ahead with those questions, I think you'll find economists will listen to those concerns, and they increasingly do. And I don't doubt, I think you're right, that a lot more has to be done, both in terms of clarifying the issues, discrimination, of what kind of policy we need, and also in executing it. And in some respects, I think that the United States did not sign the Kyoto agreement, I think was very sad for me, and for many other people across the world. There's a whole lot to be done on that. And these are issues to be addressed at the global level, where global citizenship is relevant without in any way diminishing one's national or local loyalties. And that seemed to me to be the right way of understanding identities.
The gentleman over on my left.
I'm very curious about...
Where are you?
I'm over here. Where am I? Over here. Stand up.
Okay, go ahead, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I've identified you. Yeah.
All right, now I'm identified. I want to ask you about the either-or concept that you enunciated, and in terms of globalization versus nationalism, and in terms of multiple identities versus singular identities. It seems to me that it's a force and counterforce that makes it harder and harder to find the resolutions that you discussed, and I'd like to hear your thoughts about that.
You know, I was arguing against either or, of course. Indeed, the sentence in which either or figured in my speech was to say that it does not take an either or form. But that doesn't make your question wrong, because I certainly do take the view that people have at most one identity or a singular identity, and the view that they're plural identities, that is an either or position. But that's just a mathematical point, because, if you have three, it is not one, I think. And so there's no way you could say that I do believe in single identity maximally, however I happen to have five of them. I think that seems to me to be not permissible as a thought. But I think the underlying sense in your question is to say that some people may accept the great importance of some kind of a single identity without necessarily wanting to deny that they have other less important multiple identities. If that's the form, if I may reinterpret your question, then I think that could be the case. And I do discuss it sometimes. It would become very important. Some identity will dominate over others. But it could vary. Your vegetarian identity, if you are a vegetarian, may be extraordinarily important if you're going to a dinner, but not if you're going to a lecture in the Philadelphia Free Library. And so depending on the context, some identity may be altogether dominant. But that doesn't conflict with the multiple identity view. So within the, broad house of multiple identities, there will be situations in which a single identity is so spectacularly more relevant than it just dominates. There's nothing wrong with it. It wasn't naturally born to be dominant. He happens to be dominant in those circumstances. That's the distinction. But then there are other situations, like my childhood, the broad Indians or the broad human beings of January being turned into fierce Muslims or fierce Hindus of July. There is a real question. Do you want to see yourself as a member of one community intent on doing harm to the other, or broadly as an Indian, or as an Asian, or as a human being? That is a time when you have to ask the question that multiple identity is central. That sense of singular identity which instigators are instilling in you is to be resisted. I think it's a lovely poem of Ogden Nash, which says, any boy in school can love like a fool, but hating my boy is an art. Now that art is is cultivated by the illusion of singular identity, being told people, look, and, you know, the response is this: how can you say about this broad Indian, broad human being, broad Asian, when members of our community are being killed by them, and when our women are being raped? Well, that's waving a bloody flag, certainly, and that can certainly get you to have that result. But that's the point when multiple identity has to be very strongly asserted, it seems to me.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's thank our wonderful author, Amartya Sen. Please join us upstairs. Meet Dr. Sen. Get a book. Get it signed. We'll see you upstairs.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.